You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I'm Louise Steinman, the Cultural Programs Director for the Library Foundation, and it's my great pleasure to welcome and introduce our speakers tonight. In his review in the New York Times of Tom Rockman's The Imperfectionist, humorist Christopher Buckley wonders how someone so young could have acquired such a precocious grasp of human foibles. Rockman's novel follows the inner workings of an English language newspaper based in Italy. And among his marvelous cast of characters, which how many of you have read? I think Tom and Carolyn are going to want to ask you that too. Among his marvelous cast of characters at this winding down phase of the newspaper era, we meet Lloyd Burko, a past his prime reporter, Arthur Gopal, a sad sack obituary writer, Herman Cohen, the paper's grammarian and style cop, and you can feel his pain when Tony Blair is listed as a deceased Japanese dignitary. There's an editor-in-chief who has just discovered that her husband is cheating on her, and the paper's helpless young Cairo stringer, Winston Chung, and the paranoid copy editor, Ruby Zaga, who always checks into a hotel on New Year's Eve so she can pretend to be a stranded American business traveler rather than a dateless 40-something with no prospects. The paper's chief financial officer, Abby, whose job includes sacking the paper's employees, finds herself on a plane en route to Atlanta, seated next to a man she's just canned. That was a great scene. Tom Rockman was born in London, and he's a graduate of the University of Toronto and the Columbia School of Journalism. He was a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press, stationed in Rome, and from 2006 to 2008, he worked as an editor at the International Herald Tribune in Paris, and he has the great smarts to live in Rome. Carolyn Kellogg is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. I'm sure many of you know her wonderful features and her indispensable blogs for Jacket Copy. She reviews books and writes about authors. Her work has recently appeared in the anthology Devil's Punch Bowl by Red Hen Press and the Columbia Journalism Review. And she sometimes follows the inner workings of a certain newspaper based in Los Angeles, which has its own cast of unique characters. Please welcome Tom Rockman and Carolyn Kellogg. Thank you.
Hello. So I'm going to begin with a reading from the Arthur Gopal chapter. He's the obituary writer at this newspaper in Rome. And each of the chapters, for those of you who haven't read the book yet, has a title to it. And the title refers to a headline which is in some way embedded within that chapter. So this one is called World's Oldest Liar Dies at 126. Obituary writer Arthur Gopal. Arthur's cubicle used to be near the water cooler, but the boss is tired of having to chat with him each time they got thirsty. So the water cooler stayed and he was moved. Now his desk is in a distant corner, as far from the locus of power as possible, but nearer the cupboard of pens, which is a consolation. He arrives at work, flops into his rolling chair, and remains still. This persists until inertia and continued employment cease to be mutually tenable, at which point he wriggles off his overcoat, flicks on the computer, and checks the latest news reports. Well, no one has died. Or rather, 107 people have in the previous minute, 154,000 in the past day, and 1,078,000 in the past week. But no one who matters. That's good. It's been 9 days since his last obit, and he hopes to extend the streak. His overarching goal at the paper is indolence, to publish as infrequently as possible, and to sneak away when no one is looking. He's realizing these professional ambitions spectacularly. He opens a manila folder so that if anyone happens past, he can flutter sheets, peer up irascibly, and mutter preparedness, which seems to put most people off. Not all people, sadly. Clint appears behind him, and Arthur swivels around in his chair, as if twisted by a garrote. Clint, hi. Morning. Yeah. No. I've been over the wires. I mean, there was nothing obvious. I mean, not to me, at least. I mean, not so far. Arthur despises this tendency to justify himself so abjectly to his superiors. He should just shut up. Didn't you see it? See what? Are you serious? Clint is a specialist in queries that are at once hectoring and incomprehensible. Don't you read email? Wake up, faggot. He raps Arthur's monitor as if it were a skull. Anybody home? Clint Oakley, Arthur's boss, is a dandruff-reigning, baseball-obsessed, sexually resentful Alabamian with a toilet brush mustache and an inability to maintain eye contact. He's also the culture editor, an ironic posting if considered. Rectum, he says, apparently meaning Arthur, and struts back to his office. Well, if history has taught us anything, Arthur muses, it is that men with mustaches must never achieve positions of power. Sadly, the paper has not heeded this truism, because Clint has authority over all special sections, including obituaries. Lately, he has heaped endless chores upon Arthur, ordering him to collate This Day in History, Brain Teasers, Puzzle Wuzzle, The Daily Ha Ha, and World Weather, in addition to his regular necrological duties. Arthur finds the email Clint was referring to. It's from the editor-in-chief, Kathleen Salson, who wants preparedness, that is to say, an obituary prepared before the subject dies, on Gerda Erzberger. Who on earth is that? He checks the internet. She turns out to be an Austrian intellectual, once lauded by feminists, then decried by them, and then forgotten. And why should the paper care that she's about to die? Well, because Kathleen happens to have read Erzberger's memoirs while at college, and, as Arthur knows, news is often a polite way of saying editor's whim. Kathleen arrives to discuss the piece. I'm working on it right now, he says preemptively. On Gerda? Gerda, do you know her personally? If the answer is yes, his assignment assumes fresh peril. Not well. You know, I met her a couple of times at events. And so she's not a friend, then, he suggests, hopefully. And how urgent would you say this is? Which is to say, when's she planning to die? Unclear, Kathleen responds. She's not having treatment. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's not typically good with cancer. Listen, I'd like us to do this properly for once. We're going to give you enough time to get an interview with her, go up there and so on, not just working from clips. Go up there? Go up where? She lives outside Geneva. You can have the secretaries work out the travel arrangements. Travel. Travel means effort and a night away from home. Bleak. And nothing is worse than obit interviews. He must never disclose to his subjects what he's researching, because they tend to become distressed. So he claims to be working on a profile. He draws out the moribund interviewee, confirms the facts he needs, then sits there, pretending to jot notes, stewing in guilt, remarking, "Oh, extraordinary, and did you really?" All the while, he knows how little will make it into print. Decades of a person's life, condensed into a few paragraphs, with a final resting place at the bottom of page 9, between Puzzle Wuzzle and World Weather. At this disheartening thought, he sneaks out of the office to fetch his daughter. Pickle, who is 8, emerges from the school, satchel strap around her throat, arms flat at her sides, pot belly distended, glasses scanning nothing in particular, her untied shoelaces flailing with each step. "Antiques?" he asks, and she slips her hand into his, squeezing it in affirmation. To Via dei Coronari they amble, hand in hand. He observes her from above, her tangled black hair, tiny ears, the thick lenses that bend and swell the cobblestones. She babbles softly and snorts with amusement. She's a wonderful nerd, and he hopes that won't change. He'd be distressed if she were cool. It'd be as if his flesh and blood had grown up to be purple. "Your aspect," he says, "recalls that of a chimpanzee." She's humming softly and offers no response. After a minute, she says, "And you remind me of an orangutan." "I can't argue with that." "No, cannot argue with that." "Oh, By the way, he adds, I have a new one for you. Tina Pachutnik. Say it again. Pachutnik, Tina. She shakes her head. It's impossible to say. Do you like the Tina, at least? I'm willing to consider it. She's been looking for a pseudonym. Not for any purpose, but because it took her fancy. What about Zeus? She asks. It's taken, I'm afraid, although he has actually been gone long enough. There'd probably not be much room for confusion. Would you be using it like that? Would it be Zeus on its own, or would it be Zeus something? She opens her pudgy hand within his cool, dry palm, and he releases her. She drifts, stepping over her own feet, beside him, but abstracted, apart. And then she swoops back, plunges her fingers into his, and looks up, nostrils swelling with mischief. What? He says. Frog, she replies. I forbid it. Frog is a boy's name. They enter one of the opulent antique shops on Via de' Coronari. The clerks watch Arthur and Pickle closely. The two of them come here often, never buying, except once when she knocked over a mantle clock and Arthur had to pay for it. She prods a 1920s telephone. Oh yeah, you hold that part to your ear, Arthur explains, and you talk into the other bit. But how do you make a call? He sticks his finger into the dial and cranks a rotation. You've never seen a phone like this before? My God, when I was growing up, this is all we had. Imagine the strife. Hard times, my dear, hard times. Back home, Arthur prepares her a Nutella sandwich. She eats one every afternoon, legs dangling from the kitchen chair, smudges of chocolate accruing on the underside of her nose. He tears off the crust and pops it into his mouth. Father tax, he explains, chewing. She doesn't object. When Visantha's car pulls up outside, Pickle hurriedly swallows her last bite, and Arthur hastens to rinse off the sticky plate. It's as if a teacher approached. How was work? He asks his wife. Okay, what are you guys up to? Nothing much. Pickle ambles off to the television room, and Arthur absentmindedly follows. They chat in there and laugh at their TV show. Visantha trails in. What are you watching? Oh, just some junk, he replies. Pickle hands him the remote and wanders off to her room. He watches her go down the hall, then turns to Visantha. You know what she told me today? She doesn't remember the 20th century. Isn't that terrifying? Not particularly. What are we doing for dinner? Pickle, he calls down the hall. Any thoughts on dinner? The secretaries book Arthur from Rome to Geneva by rail, a 10-hour journey with connections in Milan and Brig. Supposedly, this saves money on a short-notice flight, but is a colossal nuisance for him. He boards the early train at Stazione Termini, buys pastries in the cafeteria carriage, and, squashed amid the second-class rabble, settles into the first volume of Erzberger's memoirs, which is called, modestly, In the Beginning. From the author photo, Erzberger is, or was, in her early 30s, pretty and gaunt, with shoulder-length dark hair and twisted ironic lips. The picture is from 1965, when the book came out. She must be in her 70s by now. As his train pulls into Geneva in the early evening, he lifts his nose from the book and stares at the seat back before him. From the blurbs on the internet, he had expected a weary, politically dated autobiography. Instead, her prose communicates courage and humanity. He studies her photo again and feels scandalously unprepared. He passes customs, obtains Swiss francs, and finds a cabbie who will take him to her house, which is just across the French border. The taxi drops him on a wet country road. The red taillights disappear down the hill. He's sweaty, uncertain, late. He dislikes being late, yet invariably is. He rubs his hands together, huffs a breath cloud onto them. Yes, this is the place. That's the right number. And the pines, like she said. After a little searching, he finds a gate within the pleached fence and enters. Her home is built of sturdy timber beams, with icicles hanging from the eaves like wizard's caps. He snaps one off he can never resist and turns around to survey the twilight sky. A crust of clouds overlays the Alps. The icicle drips down his wrist. She opens the door behind him. Hi, sorry I'm late, he says, then switches to German. Sorry, I was just admiring the view. Come in, she says. You can leave the icicle outside, please. Thank you.
Ooh, yikes. Oh, if it rings, pull it closer. See?
I have serious microphone troubles everywhere I go, so if this one holds up through the whole thing, it'll be a success.
I'm trying to draw your problems away. So that was Arthur, and in The Imperfectionist, I wonder, Arthur has a really surprising trajectory from being the guy by the water cooler that nobody wants to talk to, and I wonder, do you feel like your characters get what they deserve?
I don't think so. No, not necessarily. I don't even particularly think of it in those terms because I don't think I consider the story trajectory in terms of justice and meeting it out, even though in some cases it is meted out and in others it isn't. It's funny when you're trying to come up with the right ending, and people have said of this book that many of the chapters do end with a sort of twist. Not all of them, but some of them do. In retrospect, I sometimes go back and I try to figure out why it was that they ended that way or why I came to that particular conclusion. And there's all sorts of other aspects of the writing process that I can anatomize and figure out exactly why it was. But it often seems that the ending has almost an inevitable feel about it. Not inevitability when you're writing it. When you're writing it, you might have a vague sense of the conclusion, but you're not really sure until you've gotten there. But once that finality has been reached, then it seems that it could have been no other way. And I don't think it's necessarily justice, but something inexplicable almost.
So you weren't a fan of choose-your-own-adventure books growing up?
I was, actually. I hadn't thought of those since about age 8, but yeah, I did used to like it quite a bit.
Because that's exactly the opposite.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, one of the things that Erzberger says when Arthur is interviewing her is, "Those who dispute me are fools." And she has such this grand imperiousness.
Yeah.
God, I am so loud. I am so sorry, everyone. I'll just talk. No, I can't. I wonder, do you think that are there characters that are that big that you've encountered in your own experience as a journalist that are that grand and that imperious and that certain of themselves?
Well, just to explain also the context of that discussion, once he's settled into her house there, then of course he has to proceed with this slightly awkward interview. And over the course of that interview, they end up discussing issues such as ambition, something that he's sorely lacking in, and something that she's had in spades. And so she does come out with this line at a certain point. And, you know, I suppose that when I've met people through journalism and even met some significant grand people, I'm more often struck by how people aren't particularly grand in person and how... I think grandeur almost requires that you not know the person, that there's a certain distance, in the same way as glamour requires a certain degree of fantasy, that nobody is glamorous if you spend the full day with them. And I think it's the same with the great grand people of any time, including ours. And it's not to say that they don't do grand things or don't deserve attention and deserve even great admiration. But I suppose that you want your grand people to be... I mean, for example, let's say take an icon of a grand person, a Winston Churchill type. I mean, I can't really imagine him doing anything than sort of, you know, delivering great speeches, holding cabinet meetings, and drinking champagne and smoking cigars. Beyond that, I can't really imagine him... I mean, what else would he do without somehow diminishing... the grandeur of the fellow.
I read somewhere recently that he only met his father 3 times, That he like wasn't even a boy enough to meet his father more than three times.
Yeah, and I think that there are all of these aspects, just human aspects, that that perhaps grand people even try to diminish, at least in their public persona. But when you encounter them, I mean, I remember encountering a secretary of the U.S. government who I won't name because I'm about to malign him slightly. But I just remember it was an interview that I did with him, and. You know, he wasn't one of the most important, certainly wasn't one of the grandest, but I was just astonished that this man had that sort of position. And I was frankly more fascinated with his very impressive toupee than with the course of the interview. And you know, I'm certain he had many other fine qualities, and that the hair loss certainly wasn't his fault. But I think that my point is just that the people aren't really that grand in person, and I suppose in a way it ties in a little bit with the book, which is about a lot of things. But one of the things it's about is how people are flawed, and how even grand romanticized notions are rarely quite as you expect them to be.
So I guess the grand romanticized notion would be of this paper, or of delivering the news as a kind of mission. And I think that one of the interesting tensions is that newspapers deliver the news, which is a truth, some sort of objective truth, but these are all people with very detailed and sort of mushy lives that are messy. And I wonder if you were thinking about that tension between the news and the people who have to report the news, and how it's facts. I'm sorry, I work for a newspaper. I can't even say that with a straight face.
Mm-hmm.
It's just facts in mainstream media with no humans. But the tension between the news itself and the people who have to bring the news into being.
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that struck me from the outset, actually from my earliest days in the field when I was just entering it and trying to grapple and understand how one would encounter the amazingly disturbing and tragic and complex and fascinating things that one presumably would in that career. And I remember, as an example, when I was at journalism school, and we were taken to Washington as part of one course, and sort of trooped through all sorts of the, you know, the Washington Post and the State Department, and met all sorts of people. And at one point, we met a quite eminent journalist, and he had covered Bosnia, and he was talking about all of the bloodshed that he had seen there, and you know, and how another aspect of his great career. And I said at a pause in this lunch, I said, you know, what was it actually like? I mean, the, you know, work aside, what was it like to have seen such horrors up close? And he kind of looked at me as if I was transparent, as complete incomprehension that he had witnessed these things and had written about them and spoken about them at length, but they hadn't really impacted him as a person. That really there were wholly other things that had been probably on his mind that day. Perhaps meeting his deadline, or perhaps more personal things. Maybe he was hoping to make a call to his wife, and that's not to say that journalists are all calloused, cold people. But I think there is a respect in which you are in this strange job where you're confronted each day by these gigantic crashing waves of the biggest stories in the world. And to function properly, you can't be affected personally. And you have to, in a way, try to transform the complexity and multiplicity of experience into copy. And if you are battered by these events on a personal level, then you probably won't be able to do the job very well.
So Kathleen, at one point, who's the editor, and she's a cold and very sort of clinically ambitious kind of a editor, I would say. She is trying to remember like news that happened yesterday. She's like, it's not on front page. Like, it doesn't even register with her anymore. Does that create like a kind of, how could you play with something like that? How does that feed her character?
Well, I suppose that in her case, she is an extraordinarily driven woman, a very intelligent woman who has had a successful career. She began at the paper in Rome, and then she went back to Washington and sort of went up several rungs in a newspaper there, and then
is sort of in middle management position and has to decide whether she'll stay it there and battle her way to the top, or maybe take a chance and come to this newspaper in Rome and actually take it over and see what she can do with it. And the issue of ambition is something that runs through this novel, among other issues. Even in the Arthur story that we were talking about before, that's very much a part of it. Now, I think that in her case, she's confronted by the fact that that she sort of unexpectedly has a personal life collide with her professional one. And that's something that this sort of collision and the balance between the professional and the personal is something that happens all the way through the book. And you know, then as the book continues, you also have this the rather unexpected case of the big news story suddenly becoming the paper itself, without explaining exactly what I mean for those who haven't read it. There's a way in which these people's lives are they're doing their news stories, but the real story is when they've left the newsroom. The real point of each story is their life outside it, and the headlines of the day are what they leave within the office. And that's what it's like in the business often, that you do have your life outside of it. But in the book, eventually there's a point at which the crashing issues of the day crash into the paper.
You mean the journalism's death knell?
Yes, exactly.
So I thought one of the great things about the excerpt that you read was that it was so funny, and it reminded me that the book was funny, because as someone who works at a newspaper, I found it to be sort of... also very tragic, and I wonder if those two things were a balance for you, or if it's just me as a reader.
For me, what I love most in narratives and in fiction, absolutely, but also in film as well, and maybe in life also, is a combination of things that are very tragic and humorous as well. And it seems that for me, humor is a consequence of the fact that a great deal of life is extremely hard and extremely upsetting and difficult. And it's precisely for that reason that things are humorous in a backwards way. And it's a relief and a release. And humor without any context of the fact that the world is difficult is fairly thin humor and false humor to me. And on the other hand, viewing the world simply as bleak, without any relief, without any humanity, and without the wonderful resourcefulness of people to find amusement and humor in bitter moments, that would be missing the point too.
So when you were working on the book, most people who are... you were living in Rome? Were you living in Paris?
I was living in Paris when I wrote this, yeah.
So, okay, you have a full-time job. You're working for a newspaper, which is a hard job, as we learn chapter after chapter. Like, if you're Craig Menzies, you just do it 20 hours a day. If you're an editor, you do it 20 hours a day. Or more if your BlackBerry's on. And you're living in Paris, which I hear does not suck. And you're like, you know what I'm really going to do? I'm going to sit down and write a novel. Like, where did that come from? What was the impulse?
Well, I had actually wanted to write fiction for years and years and years, and journalism was a sneaky way to write fiction ultimately. And what had happened was that I wasn't writing fiction when I was writing the journalism.
He's not that guy.
Yeah, legal papers served. What happened? What I had this kind of long-term strategy that I hatched when I was 22, and I was just graduating from the University of Toronto, and I had sort of fallen in love with fiction and with writing and making my preliminary, very juvenile, bad attempts to make up stories in my dorm room and just absolutely besotted by the process of it. And the way that I would be sort of transported and disappear in a way into my imagination and then emerge at the end. And I thought, this is what I desperately want to do. But I also felt incredibly inadequate in terms of my own experience, that not to mention my ability, but I felt that that my great heroes in writing, and there are so many of them, but they, you know, there's, let's say, the George Orwell types, or the Dostoevsky or Isaac Bashevis Singer, and on and on, they all seem to have had lives that were so much more spectacular than mine and interesting than mine. And I'd been born in London and grown up in Vancouver in tranquility and with fairly pleasant parents, both of them psychologists, for what it's worth. And so I thought.
Then you went to the tough streets of Toronto.
Exactly, on the mean streets of Toronto. Canadians are really brutal. They can say such mean things. Anyway, so I thought that I needed to become a bit more worldly and to see the world too, and that perhaps journalism would be a quick way to do that. And it was a way to do it. It wasn't entirely quick. I was in it for almost a decade overall. But I did get to go to a lot of countries. And then in the end, when I was in Paris, I started to really try to write a novel. But I would just to explain a little bit about the circumstances of when I was in Paris. What I was doing then was I had moved there. I'd quit my job as a reporter in Rome, moved to Paris to write. I made an attempt. It was more or less a botched failure.
Did you get a garret?
I want to say yes, but it wasn't. I think technically a garret is the top floor, and I had very noisy people above me, so it was worse than a garret.
It was like a sub basement to a garret.
Yeah, it was a small hardwood floor, very thin windowed apartment in the right bank in a kind of slightly slummy neighborhood, but near very nice things, and. And I would sit there, and it was amazingly cold. And I used to often type in gloves, actually, which is very difficult. Fingerless ones work though. and so I would be working away there. But really, it failed. I didn't get anywhere with that first attempt. I was out of money, and I went to the International Herald Tribune to support myself. And I would work there for 6 months of each year, save my money, and then write. So that's how I did. That's why I came up with the book. It was over the course of that period.
And have you found in the time that you've spent working in journalism that journalists are different kinds of people? Or could this be like The Office in a Rome newspaper?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I mean, I think that there are certain characteristics that are particularly journalistic-y. And then there are other features that are just life in an office. I mean, life in an office is such a strange and generally faintly unpleasant experience. It has its benefits, but it makes me think a bit of school, in that you're thrust together with this group of people that you wouldn't necessarily choose to be with, but you have to spend hours and hours and hours with them. And you can't get out. I mean, at least a job you can sort of quit, but then usually you have reasons that you can't quit. So, so I think that some of those dynamics and some of the tensions of any office are definitely true in the newsroom, and also something that I write about indirectly in this book, about the whole experience of having people sitting next to you, perhaps for years and years, and you never really know much more about them than the stupid cartoon on their coffee mug and the photos, and hear a little bit when they go on vacation what they did, but you don't know a great deal about somebody beside whom you might pass hours every day and years of your life. And one of the things that I tried to do in this book is to sort of follow all of these different characters out, and then they return to the office and reappear in each other's stories so that you would see them from a different perspective. But anyway, I'm getting off subject.
Let's actually talk about the structure of the book a little bit.
Yes.
Because I found that it was, I think, one of the most elegantly structured novels I've read in a long time, because you start sort of in the present day with Lloyd, who is an old stringer who is really like at the last gasp of his career. But at the same time, you give us a little bit of just a taste of what it was like when, at the very end of that chapter, a taste of what it was like when the paper started. And then those two chronological paths eventually converge. Could you talk a little bit about how the structure came to you? You've got all these different people at different places in the paper and at different times.
Yeah, I think that one thing I would begin with is just that I think that there's a false premise about the way that writers come up with things and stories, or at least I do, which is that there's this notion that there's a moment of inspiration where you suddenly, the idea comes to you. People will often say, when did you come up with that idea? But at least in the process for me, it's it's a matter of months and months and months of reworking things and adding things and it's difficult in retrospect to look back and find exactly when that moment arose, because it's a process that shifts and changes until it finally takes on a form that just feels sort of natural. But in the case of coming up with the structure, really, it was it originated in a hope to make a novel out of stories and to find some way to sew them all together. And the way to do that was to have a common setting. And of course, the setting of international news in Rome was something that I felt I could write about with a degree of authenticity. And then I began to be intrigued by the idea of having this sort of interstitial, if that's the word, sections that would go between each of the chapters. And you would see then the progressive history of the paper in a way that would also give me a chance to talk about the course of journalism as it has developed and then kind of fallen apart after the war.
So you really set it up kind of as a romance, literally. And I'm using literally okay there, I think. Herman Cohen has an issue with literally, and yes. If he were only copy editing the internet right now, we would be so much better off.
Yes, we would.
So you set it up as kind of a romance, and a romance that eventually fizzles. Mm. You guys all know that the romance of people with newspapers is fizzling, right? Okay. So I'm not giving anything away. But I wonder, how much was that on your mind? And do you think newspapers have a chance?
When you say how much was that on my mind, you mean
when you were working on
it? But you mean what was what on my mind?
The sort of romantic, the romance of readers with newspapers, or the role of newspapers.
I was aware of that, and I was aware of having been prey to it myself as well when I entered the field. Even if I hadn't gone into it wanting particularly to be a journalist, I was also drawn in by my notions of what it might be like, you know, the His Girl Friday scenes of wisecracking and the crusading of all the president's men and all those sorts of things. So I was having discovered a world that was completely different from that when I worked in it, then it was a pleasure to have a chance to kind of describe this industry that is so often spoken about, but not in a particularly clear or honest way. So that was something that I really enjoyed doing. In terms of the fate of newspapers and people losing their romance with it, I don't even know that in this period people have had much romance with newspapers for quite a while. Even when I started in the business, before the whole online onslaught, some people loved newspapers, but you know, readership was declining terribly, and it was in trouble then. I think I myself, as somebody who in the business had all sorts of qualms about it and didn't particularly enjoy being a journalist some of the time, I nonetheless find myself in the odd position of feeling really sad to see newspapers dying as they are and seeing what they're being replaced by, which isn't the same thing. And, you know, I'm sure that this new system has some qualities of its own, and perhaps we'll all become accustomed to it and forget the old. But I believe that we certainly do lose a great deal when newspapers die, as so many of them are.
And so, if we go back to the book, what are some of the people that we're losing? These people whose lives you've embroidered for us. Where are we losing the Herman Cohens? Are we losing the poor Ruby Zegas?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think what we're losing in a kind of very simple, straightforward way is we're losing editors. And what I mean by that is that in the newspaper world, in the traditional media print world, then you had this whole layer of people who had studied everything or studied a particular area and who had spent their careers and their lives trying to figure out exactly what it was that would be most interesting to their readers. And this was decades of expertise and knowledge, and the new system online of reading is that we are sort of the editors. So everything is out there and available, which on a superficial level is a wonderful development, because it means that you don't have people telling you what you should know. You can pick whatever you want. But the downside to it all, in my view, is that I actually want experts now and then in my life. I mean, I don't feel that I'm in a position to sift through the billions of potential bits of information that are out there and make a decision as to what is most relevant. I would like somebody whose job it is to decide those things and inform me. And that's the experience that I get when I have a chance to read a newspaper, is that I turn the page and I see an amazing feature story on you know, unrest in Tunisia. And I wouldn't have gone online and looked for that story. If I'd gone online, I'd be watching video of a cat playing the piano. It's very, very adorable.
So you said that one of the two of the sort of hallmarks that you used to talk about the role of newspapers when they were sort of heroic were two movies, All the President's Men, yeah. And which I know was a book first. I know that. And His Girl Friday. Is the Imperfectionists going to ever maybe be a movie?
Well, it's been optioned by Brad Pitt's production company, so they're looking into that and working on it, and they seem to be making very good progress. You know, as I was mentioning to you before, I think everybody in this city will know that when it comes to making a film, it's a long and arduous and complex process, and one whose fate is never really certain until you're actually eating the popcorn. So I think that. That we'll see, but I would say that I've been delighted to see their enthusiasm, and I've met with the head of the production company and other people involved in working on it, and they are so enthused, and they have so many wonderful ideas that I think it's very positive, very hopeful.
So, this is your first book, and you've been on book tour for how many days now? On this round?
6 years, I think.
And you took a meeting today, right?
I did.
Where was your meeting?
At CAA.
And was it like Entourage?
I don't really know the TV show Entourage well, but I have seen snippets of it because my girlfriends are quite a fan, and it was exactly like every if I had imagined it beforehand. It would have been that, which is so odd because my whole life seems to be me imagining things beforehand and getting it completely wrong. but this was one of those cases where it felt completely like it. It was just so opulent, and everybody seemed so much cooler than me, and everybody was walking around with a sort of swagger and confidence, and the intensity of ambition in that place was this kind of amazing buzz that was on the edge of oppressive.
And so for being out with your first book, it sounds like things are sort of going pretty well when you were sitting in Paris working, like, you know, like thinking, well, I'm just going to have soup for lunch again because I don't want to go back to work for another 3 months. Is it hard to reconcile that with your current, like, actually day-to-day experience?
It is sort of, in a way. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I think that when you get fortunate, as I have, then the fortune comes in increments, and occasionally one of those events is so sudden and significant, like, for example, the day that I knew the book was going to be published, that it feels like an explosion, and it's one of those flashbulb moments that you'll never ever forget in your life. But other things just happen, you know, there are emails exchanged, and there are, you know, you're booking flights and this and that, and so, you know, you find that you just absorb and assimilate the new situation you're in. Nonetheless, you recall well just a year ago, 2 years ago, I spent years just thinking, God, it would be so incredible if one day I could actually publish a book. I mean, if I could just have a book published, I don't need it. You know, I could die after that, and I would have done the thing that I intended to do. And even if I have to do it on the day I die, I want it. I want a book. And so you know, now that there's one in your hand with my name on it, and
it's beautiful.
And yeah, and even being at an event like this, it's very, very hard to to kind of to recognize that was you and that you're not still there and that you're here. It's wonderful too.
I think we have to go to questions in a second. I have a couple more, but are there any hands? Please raise your hand. There's somebody down here in the front row.
Thank you. Hi, I've got two questions, and one is about your trajectory from London to Canada to Paris to Rome. I mean, how did you achieve that? And the second one is, what are you working on now?
The first two stops on that trajectory are thanks to my parents, because I was 7 at the time. So I was born in London, and my parents, for work reasons, moved to Vancouver when I was at 7. And then, you know, I think that just as part of my hope to see the world and also probably partly because of a sense of rootlessness that I had, for two reasons. One, because I think having moved at 7, even though, you know, the culture in Canada is not profoundly different from Britain, it did dislocate me a little bit and made me feel not quite from one place nor the other. My family as well come from all sorts of different countries, and so none of them have a particular state that they strongly identify with. And so I found myself initially traveling around hoping that I would find a city or a country that would really feel like home. And then after a while, I realized that it seemed unlikely at this stage that I would find such a place, and that there was just something in me that would make me travel around and pluck little bits of different cultures that I liked and appreciated and try to bring them with me. And as a result, I tend to move quite often, and after a few years, you know, I'm ready for the next place. In terms of what I'm working on next, I'm working on a second novel right now, and I don't divulge the details of what it's about because it's sort of too early really to do that, and I tend to be quite secretive about what I'm working on anyway. In fact, when I was writing The Imperfectionist, nobody on earth knew anything about it until it was done and I gave it to my parents and a couple of friends really to read. But I think it's for two reasons that I'm so private about the subject. It's one is because I fear that if I expose it too early, then it could be shifted out of its rightful form, just because I'm not really prepared for to have other input. And the other part of it is just that I think I don't have the confidence in what I'm doing to withstand necessarily somebody else's response or criticism until I've got it to the absolute final stage, the stage at which I feel there's nothing more I could do, and I'm certain that it's the best I could do at that point in my life. Otherwise, I always fear that I'll say, you know, I'm writing a book from the perspective of a hippopotamus, and somebody will look at me with aghast, and then I'll think, what am I doing?
Oh gosh, maybe that's a bad idea.
Yeah, that's not the idea, by the way.
Is there another question over here in the blue?
I thought that Christopher Buckley's review was so extraordinary. I mean, it just was sparkling. I bought the book that day. Like, how much do you love him?
I actually have this vague suspicion that Christopher Buckley is my mother in disguise. Yeah, that was an amazing review. It was so extraordinarily favorable, and people, you know, say they've not seen one like that before. And you know, it's also one of those strange points in my life where if it had been given to anybody else on the earth to review, then my career wouldn't have gone like that. I mean, if I'd gotten lucky, somebody else would have liked it too. But the effusiveness and incredible enthusiasm of that review just really did change my fortunes. And so I'm going to buy him lunch in London soon.
Hands? The blonde lady.
I had a question because you talked about how it sounded like originally these were stories and then you wanted to turn them into a novel. And I was just wondering, at what point did you decide to do that, and why did you decide not to just pursue it as stories?
Well, That's right. That is how it went. And initially, the characters and some of the storylines came to me, and I started to have all of this sort of these varied characters, and they weren't linked together in a particular novel. But I wanted to write a novel in particular. I didn't want to write short stories, and I suppose that it was really what I wanted to do was I wanted to try to combine the two. I wanted to see if it was possible to combine two forms that I adore. That's what it came down to, that as a reader, I love novels and I love the short story, and each of them has such a different effect on the way that you read, both in the duration and your experience with the characters and the way that they linger with you or not. And I loved the idea, now that I had these characters in my mind, to try to make a novel of them. And that was what I aspired to do as well, I suppose, in terms of my aspirations of being a writer. I wasn't trying to get stories published in magazines or anything. I had this dream of doing a novel. That for me was the watermark. And so I had these characters that I was really enthralled by, and then I sought a way to link them all together, and it ended up being the newspaper world.
Hands.
I have a cousin who has a 25-year career with an East Coast newspaper, and he said, and I hadn't read Christopher Buckley's review, but my cousin recommended the book, and he said, you know, he got it right. You have to read this book. He really got it right. So I would ask, what kind of input have you had from other journalists? And what has that meant to you?
And while you're pouring water, I'll say that I talked to two different people in the building today who are like, I started it and I couldn't finish, as though they had been watching an autopsy.
Yeah, I've had incredible response from journalists, and it's been I can't say that it was a surprise so much, but I guess I was, if anything, a little worried, of course, that they would really know what it's like, and I would hope that it wasn't just my sort of warped perspective on what it had been like, and the fact that it seems to have resonated with their experiences is incredibly encouraging, and also indicates to me that there was a story that really hadn't been told about that feature of our culture. It's something that's been with us forever, and in forms will be forever. And you know, we had rather false depictions on the whole of you know, the crusading journalist type that probably inspired me to go into it a bit, or the sleazeballs on the other side, And so, you know, I set out wanting to write stories and characters, and it wasn't the news world in particular that I wanted to capture first of all, but the fact that somehow I did manage to catch it was a thrill, and I also inadvertently seem to have gotten some archetypes in the newsroom that I've gotten tons of emails from people in all corners of the world saying things like, you know, I know that person. That person works next to me, and she's driving me nuts. And I don't know how that happened, but
are you any more optimistic about the future of publishing than about the future of newspapers, or have you jumped out of one leaky rowboat and into another?
Both. It is kind of ironic that I left one industry in total decay and went to another that's at least under threat. But I'm actually I'm not as worried about the fate of book publishing as I am about the newspaper. I think that the newspaper industry has already been so profoundly undermined by what's been going on over the past few years, and I think that they haven't taken the right steps all the way along, and which begs the question, what were the right steps? I actually don't even know there were right steps. I often think back, what could newspapers have done that would have saved them, and I don't really know, though I tend to think that having given away everything they had for free wasn't really the best plan in the end. And
that's what they say in the dating books.
Is it? Knew I'd heard that somewhere. I think in the book publishing world, it's they haven't had that experience yet. You know, they're obviously not giving away entire books for free, and they've also been spared the decimation that happened to the music industry with Napster, etc. So they, in a way, they've sort of been spared. I think that the question then is not so much at the moment about the finances of the industry and so forth, as much as the readership and what's happening to readers. And that's something that concerns me profoundly. And I don't really know what is happening to them. On the one hand, I'm in a situation now where I'm meeting readers all the time, and it's so exciting and heartening, and finding people who love books like I do. And it makes me feel like, well, okay, that's clearly things are great. On the other hand, I observe in lots of people and in myself how one's concentration is so divided and diminished by technology everywhere and by the incredibly seductive thrills that all of these things offer. And the nature of something like reading a book or reading a short story even is that it requires devoted, single-minded concentration over a long period, exactly what we don't really do very much anymore. I can only hope that people will continue to read, specifically because it's an alternative to the trend of all of the rest of their day. I am sort of worried about that, and I hope that somehow people make the effort, because I think it does take an effort now. I think that it's we've found this such an incredibly attractive, sexy option online and with technology. But I think that it behooves us not to treat it like kind of free junk food. You know, that it makes sense at a certain point to try to really limit ourselves and control it, and recognize that things like books or other forms of art or other forms of conversation or study are really worth the investment and worth the focused concentration.
I paid him to do that. I think we have time for two more questions, two short questions. There's one over here and then one in the back over there.
Besides being a great story and a great piece of writing, you also have a great title. So I have a chicken and egg question, I guess. Which came first, whether it was the title and then the book, or whether you came up with the title during the writing of the book?
I came up with the title during the writing of the book. It generated really from, well, it generated in two ways, I guess. One was that that it just seemed somehow to encompass all of these characters. I wanted to get across the point that it's an ensemble piece, and that all of these stories, all of these people are rather imperfect characters. They're certainly not at all these grand types that we were talking about before, and they're weak characters, but sympathetic ones, I hope, and endearing ones too. So part of it was for that, and part of it was also because of the theme of striving and the theme of ambition and the idea in my mind of perfectionism as being in a way a sort of shorthand for disappointment and a sense that an observation of myself that I have a tendency sometimes to be a sort of a perfectionist, and it's not brought me all sorts of happiness necessarily, that I instead tend to recognize how flawed I am all the time when I'm seeking perfection. There was a particular evening when I was out for dinner, and it was a dinner party in Italian, and I speak Italian quite well, but I speak in a very bookish way because I studied intensely before I would ever speak it. I just sort of memorized all the grammar, so I speak in this incredibly stilted, bizarre way, and somebody at that dinner remarked that you know, oh, you're such a perfectionist, you get all the subjunctives right, and all I could think of when he said that is how every sentence I speak, I can feel how imperfect it is in every respect. And so I suppose that I began to develop this idea of an imperfectionist, somebody who's not driven to despair by attempting to achieve something impossible, but instead is striving, and that's the point.
Your characters all seem to be very angular and quirky, and then there are some very telling turns in each one of the stories. And I think when it comes to quirky and that kind of angular development of character, it's very hard to do well and very easy to do with a sense of artificiality. We see that all the time. I thought this was done very masterfully. My question to you is whether it's possible to do that in a longer form. In other words, to have that much intensity of character that comes so quickly. It's made possible by the format of the book, the small stories. And if you had one character that sort of carried it through, would it have been possible to do the same kind of thing?
Would you get bored of Ruby or of Arthur?
Well, the characters that appear in this book, I wouldn't necessarily get bored of them. But I did, since I conceived of them in that form, then I sort of see them. As ending when the story ends, and I don't think about turning them into a novel, say. But in terms of whether it's possible to maintain a rich character over in a broader canvas, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that in a way it should be much richer because you have not just 20 pages to invent the character, bring it to life, and tell the story, but you have all of the subsequent stories in the 280 plus pages that follow those 20 pages. So that I think that the history of that character accumulates and makes it richer and richer and richer as it goes. I think that's what you would strive for anyway. Yeah, and I think also there's something fascinating in a novel in watching a character develop over time and watching them change and watching recognizing that the character on page 280 is not the character that she was or he was on page 20. Just which is how I feel in life. I feel when I look back at something 5 years ago, I feel like I share the same memories with that person, but it doesn't feel quite like me anymore. And I think that perhaps in a way, a very fully realized character is one who is not static over the course of a long piece of writing, but is one who is the accumulation and consequence of all of their experiences along the way, plus their nature.
That's a brilliant note to end on. Thank you, Tom Rockman. And
thank you very much
for The Imperfectionists.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.